to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 29th of August, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. The year is racing past. We are now at the end of August, but as always, we are here at the beginning of the week to discuss the news of interest to nationalists. And of course, I have with me my co-host, as always, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Good day to you. I'm very well indeed. Just as last week, still enjoying the global warming dividend that we're experiencing so far, which is the warm, dry weather. We did have a bit of rain recently, but and that rain was very welcome. But the warmer weather is still continuing. We may not be so happy with this state of affairs in the long run, but for the time being, it is something which is quite new, and it's quite good to enjoy continental weather here in the UK occasionally.
Yeah, we didn't get the predicted floods, did we? They were predicting floods last week, and didn't actually show up at all. The weather is still fairly mild, but we do have lots of issues occurring that to take our minds off the good weather, don't we, with this price cap, the increase in bills. I know you've been looking at this this recent price cap and working out the costs associated with it. For our American listeners, we have a cap that's actually put on the amount that we can be charged for our electricity, and it's supposed to keep the rate that you're paying for electricity so that it doesn't actually send you into poverty. But there's been some massive increases, and and also at the same time, of course, the government are all on holiday. They're waiting for a new government, so nothing's being done about this. And there's been another massive increase in this price cap. Do you want to go into the details of this, Max?
Yeah, the organisation Ofgem has been set up to calculate and set this price cap on a regular basis. They previously used to do it every 6 months. They've now started to review things every 3 months. But the price cap is set and it's been announced to rise in October this year to £3,549 per annum, which is around about £300 a month. And the price cap that's predicted, if we compare it with the price cap that existed 12 months ago, is an increase of over £2,000. The price cap was only £1,400 last year in October 2021. Now it's an extra £2,149, which is quite a stunningly large amount of money that people are going to be, that, you know, average people are going to be expected to pay for their gas and their electricity. The if we calculate what that is on a weekly basis, that increase of £2,149 a year is £179 per month. And I've just sort of calculated that is the equivalent of everybody in the country taking on a £33,000 mortgage over a 25-year period, which in itself is a very large commitment. Can you imagine if you as a father had one of your children come to you and say, "Oh, you know, Dad, my wife and I, we've been trying to buy this house. This is the house that we want, but we haven't got enough. You know, we can't actually borrow enough to buy the house. We need an extra £30,000. You know, would you be prepared to borrow that extra £30,000 and let us have it so that we can buy the house that we need?" You know, if you were a generous father, you might consider doing that, and you might consider taking on a £30,000 mortgage in order to enable your children to have that. But that's not where it stops, you see, because the price cap is now predicted to increase in the future from the £3,500 that we'll have to pay in October to £4,600 in January, to £5,300 in April, and to over £6,500 in July. So this generosity that a parent might want to extend to their child has now reached proportions where there's going to be an increase of £5,149 in addition to the added on to the the price cap that existed 12 months ago, which is equivalent to an £80,000 mortgage. And so whereas you might sort of think, consider to yourself, well, actually, I probably could stretch to a £30,000 mortgage to help my child get on the property ladder. £80,000, well, that's a much bigger amount. It's a much more serious amount. And I would imagine that very few parents could afford to raise a mortgage of £80,000 to help their child buy a house. But we're not being asked to raise money to help children buy a house. What we're being charged for here is just the cost of heating your house. And so we're looking at the increase over last year through to July next year is going to be an increase equivalent to everybody in the country taking on an £80,000 mortgage, well, every household in the country taking on an £80,000 mortgage. And that's assuming that the mortgage was at 4% over 25 years.
Hang on there, Max. I mean, that is just staggering. Absolutely staggering. I mean, would the government loan out that amount of money for people to buy their own house? No, they wouldn't. And I mean, you could get a decent house in lots of parts of the country for £80,000. And people are just suddenly being expected to be able to find this. I mean, can everybody in the country afford an £80,000 mortgage? No, they can't. I mean, this is really serious situation that we're in here. I mean, the headline that I'm looking at here, it says it's gone up by 80% to 3,549. Fears are it could hit 7,200 next spring. So not 6,500, but 7,200. So you're going to be paying that off every year, and you're getting nothing for it but just for the heating of your house. And yet, if the banks were to loan you that money over 25 years, you could purchase an £80,000 house. This is scandalous, Max. I just wanted to, you know, really sort of drive it home what's going on there.
It is scandalous. To top it all, though, the Bank of England have announced recently that they may have to double interest rates by next year in order for us to get inflation under control. And so whereas I've made these calculations based upon a 4% mortgage rate, the mortgage rate could be 8% next year. And if there is an 8% mortgage increase, that it means that the cost of an average mortgage is going to increase by £800 a month. And that would be on top of the £800 a month for the increase in the mortgage, and that's on top of the £400 a month increase for the cost of their energy. So average couples buying an average house and that have got an average mortgage are going to have to find an extra £1,200 a month this time next year in order to pay for the electricity and the gas, and also to pay for the increase in interest rates on their mortgage. And these are colossal figures that will drive very large numbers of people in this country into poverty. These are colossal figures that will mean that a very large number of elderly people who rely on heating their homes over the winter won't be able to heat their homes. They will probably try and eat less in order to afford to pay as much electricity and gas as they possibly can, but they won't be able to afford the electricity and the gas, and so they will eat less and they will have less warmth in their homes, and a lot of people are going to die from hypothermia. Something like 20,000 elderly people die of hypothermia each year. As it is, when we have these kind of increases, how many people are going to die of hypothermia over this winter that's to come? And these are very sobering prospects. I can't imagine any other issue that would impose such beggaring costs on a nation than those that are likely to come as a result of the increase in cost of fuel and the increase in interest rates that are predicted. I can imagine that there are lots of people all over the country, as these figures start to hit home, who are going to start to panic, thinking, what on earth are we going to do? How on earth are we going to be able to afford these increases? And yet there's been silence from the political parties about this. The Conservative Party are wrapped up in their leadership election, where they're talking about other things, where they're talking about the things that the Conservatives regard as being important. The Labour Party seems to be very absent in terms of coming forward with criticism. They seem to be very absent in terms of coming forward with proposals for any solutions that can be made. And what's happened is that we have been steered into a catastrophic economic situation as far as this country is concerned over the last sort of 2 or 3 years. And nobody in positions of power are doing anything about it. And I suspect that people in positions of power, people within the establishment political parties, aren't that worried about large numbers of people dying, because firstly, if a lot of elderly people die, it means they won't have to pay out so much in terms of state pensions. And if lots of younger people die, then they can quite easily be replaced by the people who come across the channel in little dinghies every day. And so as far as maintaining the gross domestic product is concerned, the thing that seems to obsess our politicians, they probably aren't too worried about it. But from the point of view of the nation, from the point of view of the extended family that the nation represents, our nation is going to be weakened. Our nation is going to suffer as a result of this economic catastrophe, and something needs to be done. And so when election times come round and people see that there are nationalist political parties standing in their constituencies, they need to remember this time. They need to think back and remember this winter that's going to be coming, and they need to remember who it is that's led us into this economic catastrophe, and how little the people with their hands on the levers of power actually care about the survival of our people.
Well, it is a very serious situation, isn't it? I mean, you're talking about the most vulnerable people that we've got, the elderly people, the disabled people that have to stay at home all the time. I mean, the newspapers are full of the fact that 7 out of 10 pubs are going to have to close because of the electricity bills. But what about the people that are living at home? They've got to start putting people first. I mean, what sort of solutions do you think they could come up with? I mean, because they're talking about making hardship payments to the poorest people, but the hardship payments are like £150. And then they might get another one in 3 or 4 months' time. And yet we keep hearing about the billions that these energy companies are making in money. And you think, well, what is the reason for this? And we're being told, oh, well, this is because this is Putin. Putin's put the price up of the oil, and it's because of Ukraine. So what are we supposed to tell ourselves? All these people are going to die, but at least we can have gay pride parades in Kiev. I mean, that's not going to wash, is it? I think there's going to be some serious unrest over this if something isn't done about it. I mean, obviously a nationalist government would be putting the people first, and what you're pointing out there, Max, so long as they can keep importing people to replace the ones that they leave, the gross domestic product is not going to be affected, so the country will still be making enough money for the oligarchs. So what is going to get them to change? I mean, it might be that we see some serious unrest on the streets, and people say, oh, well, this is all planned, but I can't see how it is planned if it's going to be something that is likely to cause unrest. And one thing that is guaranteed to cause unrest is if people start getting hungry, if people can't afford to heat their homes. I mean, you know, they talk about bread and circuses, but if there's no bread and there's no heating, you're going to have some serious issues to deal with public order, I would have thought. I mean, what are your thoughts there, Max?
That's likely to happen. I suspect and I fear that it's probably too late for us to avert a very difficult period over this next winter. What should have been done years ago is that instead of closing down our coal mines, we should have kept our coal mines open, and we could have then used coal to produce town gas as we used to back in the 1950s and the 1960s. So we wouldn't have been dependent upon Vladimir Putin's oil in the first place. We should have kept the coal mines open. We should have continued to make town gas to supplement the North Sea gas. The North Sea gas should have been nationalised, and the North Sea gas industry should have been operated as a nationalised industry, so that priority could have been given to providing the fuel that our nation needs instead of the fuel that's being generated as a result of the explorations of the North Sea going into the international markets, where it becomes a commodity and where we then have to compete with foreign nations for the fuel, the oil and the gas that was ours and that should have been ours to sell, to use for the benefit of our nation first. And we should have only ever sold the surplus fuel, surplus gas, oil off into international markets. We shouldn't have made those given those international markets the dominant position that that exists today. Because the point is, the politicians turn around and say, oh, well, if we pin the price cap, then what will happen is that a lot of these oil, a lot of these energy companies will go bust. But what these energy companies are doing is they're just acting as a middleman. They are buying up futures in oil and gas, and they're then selling, they're then billing us for that oil and that gas. They're not actually making any oil or gas. There is still oil and gas being piped along our pipelines, but these, as we spoke about last week, these are the network of the national grid and the network of pipelines that were constructed many, many years ago by our National Coal Board I can't think what it was called now, actually, National Coal and Gas, I think they were called, where they created the distribution network that's needed in order to pipe fuel into our homes. And so if some of these fuel companies were to go bust, it wouldn't be the end of the world. It wouldn't be as bad for the nation as the nation having to face a winter of fuel poverty high interest rates.
Well, I think these companies, the energy companies, I think they're owned by foreigners as well. I don't think they're even owned by British companies. And of course, while this is all going on, we've still got tons of people turning up on our beaches to replace the ones that are going to be dying off in the winter. I've got an article here from GB News. Almost 1,300 migrants crossed the English Channel in small boats on Monday. That's not in a week, that's not in a month, that's just in one day. The largest ever number to cross in a single day, according to official figures. The numbers released by the Ministry of Defence show that 1,295 people were detected on 27 small boats in the channel yesterday. I mean, this is an armada that's turning up on our beaches. That number surpasses the previous record of 1,185 who crossed on 11th of November 2021. Until yesterday, the largest number to cross on a single day this year happened at the beginning of this month, when 696 people were spotted and recovered in the channel. So twice as many turned up in one day as the record was before. And that was twice as many as actually turned up at the beginning of the month. So this is just continuing to increase. They're all being put up in hotels. None of them are being sent back to their countries of origin. We had this plan to send the illegal immigrants, people who have broken into our country, to send them off to Rwanda, where they would have been looked after. They would have been helped out to start businesses. Rwanda wants these people to actually come to their country. And the liberal lawyers put a stop to it with the help of our legal aid. The legal aid was used to help these asylum seekers, the same legal aid that we can't afford to pay to our barristers. So the barristers are now all on strike, so no court cases can happen. And that's down to all of these cases by these asylum seekers that have been prevented from preventing us from actually sending them off to Rwanda. So it seems to me as if the government has more concern for people from other countries who wash up on our beaches than they actually do for the elderly of our own people. And of course, we've been divorced from our government, haven't we? The government is no longer representative of the indigenous British people. The government is representative of the corporation that is the United Kingdom that just wants to make as much money as it possibly can in the capitalist system, and it doesn't matter who it is that is actually making them that money. They can replace the indigenous white people with people coming from Africa, and in fact that's their stated goal, isn't it? We've got so many people here in Africa, we've got a declining birth rate here in Europe, so what we need to do is we need to transport the people from Africa into Europe. They can replace the people that are already here in Europe, and then we can still keep the system going, we can still keep earning the money, paying back the money, the usury that's inbuilt into our system, paying back that debt mountain that can never actually be paid off. And it all goes down to this divorcing of the idea that the government should be representative of the people. And it's no longer representative of us. It's no longer representative of the indigenous British people. You know, they talk about how proud they are, how diverse the cabinet is. And it's effectively saying, we're really proud that we've replaced all these white people and we've now got non-whites governing us. You know, and that's why there isn't this care for the people of the country anymore. We're just numbers to them. And if they can get rid of the weak and vulnerable,
the statistic that was released just recently is that 60% of the people arriving in dinghies crossing the channel are Albanians of military age. So they're men aged between 20 and 45, 60% of them, and they're Albanians. And so we then have to ask ourselves, who are they fleeing from? You know, is there a system of persecution in Albania? No, there isn't. Is Albania at war with one of its neighbours? No, it isn't. And so what are these people claiming asylum from? What is it that is motivating them to go to the lengths of crossing the channel in a boat? And the answer is that it isn't actually that difficult to cross the channel in an inflatable boat. So they're not actually taking a great risk, particularly when they're doing it during the summertime, when the weather is very pleasant. It may be a more arduous trip during the middle of the winter, but the bulk of these people travel across during the summertime. And one wonders how all the money that we've been spending, because we've paid the French something like 50, I think it's between 50 and 100 million pounds we've paid them in order for them to beef up their security on their beaches to stop people from launching boats. And I saw a little bit of video over the weekend a couple of French policemen who ran out and who then used a knife to burst the inflatable boat that these migrants were trying to use to cross the channel. And some of the migrants became aggressive, and one of the policemen had to use a sort of gas canister in order to drive him off. But the point is that video showed, it's quite easy to stop people from being able to cross the channel. It must be possible using the same sort of drones that are being used in their hundreds and thousands in Ukraine. It must be possible for us to fly those drones backwards and forwards along the northern coast of France, spotting the people, because, you know, the boat that was involved in the video that I saw over the weekend, the boat was something like about 25 feet long. You know, a 25 feet by 10 foot boat isn't something you can hide in your pocket. It's not something you can hide in the boot of your car. Okay, it will be deflated and you will inflate it at the last minute before you need to rush out and plunge into the sea. But the point is, the inflation of a boat like that can't be that quick. It must take some time, and it must be possible for drones to be able to spot these people and for the French police to intervene, especially when we've paid them, you know, millions of pounds to do it.
I think that's a really good idea. You know, you just use those drones, have them zipping about, and as soon as they see one of these boats, surely they can just fly up close and fire into it and deflate it before they've even got off the beach. I mean, that would be the solution. And these are Albanians that are coming over. They're the highest represented amongst crime in Britain. And we've had a huge increase in crime, particularly organised crime, gangster crime. And that's what these Albanians are all involved in. We had this horrific shooting this week in Liverpool, which looks as if it was to do with drugs. And some guy, some people were shooting at one person, and a woman opened up her door to see what the noise was all about. And the person that was being pursued, he ran into the house, and the two that were firing after him ran in there as well. And they ended up shooting this poor little girl. I think she's been killed. And the police are saying that they're looking for the shooters. They don't know who the shooters is. And mysteriously, we have not been given a description. We've not been given a description of the people that shot this little girl. I mean, what's more important, protecting the public, telling them what these criminals look like, or protecting the criminal's human rights and not stigmatizing the group that the criminal may come from? I mean, that's the reason that's given. You know, it would be racist if you were to give a description of a criminal and say that he was black. So they just don't give a description at all. I mean, that is my suspicion, that the criminal here was black. I mean, it could have been Albanian, but if it was Albanian, it's likely that they would have actually given us a description of the person. I mean, we've not seen an identikit picture. We've not been told anything at all. Just that if anybody knows anything about the gunmen, then that they should tell the police. And this is horrific that's taken place in Liverpool. We've got this massive increase in knife crime that's taking place in the multicultural centres, particularly in London. But we also have these shootings, drug shootings in Birmingham. I mean, in all the major multicultural cities, and then we see the police dancing around at gay pride marches and not turning up for burglaries. And I believe there was an ex-police officer that wrote an opinion piece about this in the Daily Mail this week that you managed to find, Max. Do you want to bring that up?
Yeah, there was, because some people listening to this, particularly if they are members of the British Police Service or the security services, who think that they need to monitor what we're doing because we are nationalists, and so therefore we are dangerous people in their view. They might like to have a read of the article, which was written by a chap called Philip Fowler, who is apparently a former Metropolitan Police Chief Superintendent, and he wrote this article for the Daily Mail. And I'll just read you a section of the article that he wrote here. Like everyone else in this country, I was shocked to hear the appalling shooting of 9-year-old Olivia Pratt Corbell in Liverpool on Monday night. For a child to be killed by a gun-wielding hitman chasing his prey into a family home is a damning indictment of the state of society and modern policing. Indeed, when I see the lawless rampant on Britain's streets, I fear we are descending into anarchy. Only 24 hours before Olivia's murder, council worker Ashley Dale, 28, was shot dead in the garden of her front of her home, less than 2 miles away. Meanwhile, we are in the grip of a nationwide knife crime epidemic, and the Met is investigating 67 murders in London so far this year. Across the country, senior officers appear to have completely lost sight of their basic role to catch and deter criminals. Their junior colleagues, the product of a woke education system, often have totally unrealistic notions of what their job entails. They are deployed without appropriate training and often behave in ways that shame the force. Increasingly, policing resembles a political activity. Some officers appear to regard painting their faces and dancing at pride festivals or taking the knee in solidarity with the hard left's Black Lives Matter movement as their duty, instead of keeping the peace. With the exception of murder investigations and pointless arrests over offensive comments on social media, every aspect of policing has broken down. Drug dealing, burglaries, car theft, dangerous driving, mass shoplifting raids, and all kinds of other crimes seem to go increasingly unchecked. It's a shocking situation. I'm afraid it's getting worse. Videos posted online in recent days reveal that all kinds of crime are becoming ever more brazen. On Tuesday night, masked men fought each other with machetes in Leeds. On Sunday, a screaming mob of about 50 young people stormed and looted a McDonald's restaurant in Nottingham, abusing and threatening staff, robbing the premises and filming themselves while they did so. An investigation is supposedly underway, although no arrests have been reported. Another film doing the rounds yesterday showed two muggers setting on a couple in broad daylight in London's Mayfair before leaping into a car and driving off. They didn't care that neighbours were yelling at them, filming them and threatening to call 999. the possibility that any police officers were within shouting distance or would do anything about the crime if they could was virtually zero, and the robbers knew it. Nearby at Hyde Park Corner on Sunday, two thieves on mopeds attempted to mug a man in a Bugatti supercar and were again filmed while doing so. They were probably trying to snatch his wristwatch. 67 watch thefts were reported in the capital last month, more than two a day. The litany continues. In Oxford Street, a gang of youths jumped and stomped over a Ferrari simply because they could, while others rampaged in a sweet superstore and grabbed everything they wanted. Gang attacks like those now commonplace across the country, and videos uploaded to Twitter and YouTube show the teenage thieves rarely bother to cover their faces. Why would they? The chances of arrest and prosecution are vanishingly small. Crimes that would have ended with a spell in Borstal 40 years ago are now routinely ignored. Shamefully, recorded crime in England and Wales is now at a 20-year high, according to figures released last month by the Office of National Statistics. Some 6.3 million crimes were reported to police in the year to March 2022, with rape and other sexual offences, violence against the person, and stalking and harassment at record highs. Amid this tsunami of human misery, just 5.6% of offences reported to the police led to a suspect being charged or summoned, a new low. As recently as 2014 to 2015, some 16% of reported offences led to a suspect being charged. That figure has collapsed. Without the police taking dangerous criminals off the streets, the fabric of society begins to fray, and that is what we are beginning to witness. Like my former colleagues in the force, and like many serving officers today, I feel anger and despair at this terrible situation, and the increasingly woke mindset of some police is scarcely helping matters. Which leads me to the farcical spectacle seen at Lincoln's annual Pride Festival last Saturday. Four officers in shirt sleeves dancing the Macarena, waving their arms and jumping on the spot in a synchronized display that had evidently taken some rehearsal. All fun down at Lincoln Pride, crowed the force's Twitter account. Even when the video was denounced as embarrassing, Lincoln's chief constable, Chris Howard, couldn't see anything wrong with it. Pride is one of the many wonderful community events we are there to police, he said, but also to allow people to look behind the uniform and see who we are. Toe-curling nonsense. The uniform is exactly what the public should see. It ought to inspire respect and represent probity. Yet, as I see it, growing numbers of police are disgracing their uniforms by behaving in an utterly inappropriate way while wearing them. A number of forces have plastered their cars with the rainbow livery of the Pride movement, while at least one officer has been pictured with his policeman's helmet painted in rainbow hues. In a sense, this tiresome virtue signalling would not matter if the police were doing their essential work, keeping the streets safe for minorities, but they are not, that they're failing to do so. According to figures obtained by the Vice News website, in the past 5 years alone, reports of homophobic hate crimes almost tripled from just over 10,000 in 2016-2017 to almost 27,000 in 2021-2022. Several horrifying gay bashings have taken place with innocent gay men hospitalised. If the police truly wanted to reach out to the gay community, that is what they would be tackling instead of parading empty gestures with a rainbow flag. Britain's economy is in free fall, with fuel prices spiralling out of control and inflation predicted to soar above 18%. Protests this winter are a safe bet. A few lawless, aggressive people could easily escalate these peaceful protests into looting and violence, just as they did in 2011, when thousands rioted across England and five people died. When the police are no longer seen as a genuine deterrent, some people will feel emboldened to act beyond the law, and Britain's policing deterrent has worsened severely since those riots over a decade ago. So I fear for the safety of our streets this winter. Radical action is needed. My proposal is for a royal commission to examine every aspect of the police and redefine its purpose, with a shake-up at every level, including how to keep politics out of policing. Britain cannot continue to be a country where dealers are free to sell drugs in every park and street corner, where break-ins are routinely ignored, and where police officers disgrace their uniform by dancing at political marches. I was deeply proud to be a copper. Now I am ashamed of what the police has become. So that's Philip Fowler. ex-chief superintendent for the Metropolitan and City Police.
Well, he points out there that there's only sort of 5% of these reported crimes that actually end up getting people being charged. I mean, how many reported hate crimes end up being charged? I would say about 99%. I mean, if somebody is offended by something they see on the internet, the police will go around there and ask the person to let them in and interview them and record it as a non-crime hate incident, even though they've been told that they need to actually show that there's some hostility there. This doesn't seem to have been received by the police, because they went round a veteran's house the other day simply for posting four pride flags together to make a swastika on his Twitter account. And there was one complaint about that, and the police went around there. So when he talks about this huge increase in hate crimes against the homophobic community, which has been produced by Vice, I very much suspect that they have included in their criteria for hate crime criticism of homosexuality on the internet. He says there have been several violent attacks against homosexuals, which, of course, we absolutely condemn. But that's only three or four violent attacks, isn't it? And yet he's talking about tens of thousands of hate crimes there. So obviously those figures have been inflated simply by hurt feelings. So, I mean, it's good that he's pointing this out, that the police are this woke policing and they're more interested in policing hurt feelings than anything else. But that appears to have eluded him when he looked at the Vice figures there and included the number of hate crimes against homosexuals, because I do think that was probably criticism on the internet rather than actual violent attacks. I mean, because it says there several people have been killed, but tens of thousands of hate crime incidents. So the violent attacks are dwarfed by the amount of criticism that people get on the internet. People should expect to find criticism on the internet. They should not expect the police to be protecting them from hearing other people with different opinions. This is Britain. We're supposed to be full of different opinions. We're supposed to have a plurality of opinions. We're supposed to be full of different eccentric type people with different opinions on the way that the world is run. We're not all supposed to be, you know, conforming to this government narrative. I think most people over the age of 40 are absolutely just flabbergasted at what's actually going on, at the way that our speech is being policed, and the younger ones, 20s and 30s, they've all been brainwashed with it at university. What are your thoughts on all of that, Max?
Well, I think that Philip Fowler obviously needed to include a certain amount of woke content in order to make the message that he was putting over as receptive, as easily receptive as possible by the powers that be. And so, you know, a chunk of this was concerned with anti-gay hate crime. But I mean, if somebody gets beaten up for being gay, it's no worse than somebody gets beaten up for being an old person. And what should happen is that the police should police the crime and not the motivation behind the crime. But the point is that what we've got here is a senior ex-police officer basically saying what we've been saying for years. It's a pity that he's had to wait until he's left the police force before he's had the freedom to be able to say this. There was a time when senior police officers could say this sort of thing without fearing for their job. But obviously those times are long past. But we should be thankful for the fact that Philip Fowler has had the courage to even say as much as he has done publicly. And he's to be commended for bringing this. But it shows that the people who interpret the drift that's taking place in this country the way that we do aren't necessarily people who are politically biased, because, you know, if I'd just stood up and made a speech like this, or I'd written an article very similar to what Philip Fowler had written, people would have said, oh yeah, but this guy, he's an extreme right wing nationalist, you can't really take any notice of what he's saying. But Philip Fowler isn't an extreme right wing nationalist. Philip Fowler is a run-of-the-mill bloke, basically, who's worked hard and had a successful career in the police. And I think he's the sort of person that we ought to take notice from in terms of interpreting how bad things are getting here in this country, and in terms of informing us so that we can make the right sort of decisions in the future. I think to a certain extent he betrayed a certain amount of naivety in calling for there to be a royal commission, because we all know who would be appointing the people to actually form the royal commission. It would be the same people that are responsible for the state of the country now anyway. I think things have gone way beyond royal commission kind of position. I think that sadly, again, I think that things have become so bad that there is going to be no clean and easy way out of this, and that we may see a very considerable breakdown in law and order in this country in the years to come, and the solution to the problem may end up being just as violent as the violence that necessitates it.
And of course, we've been predicting this and trying to avoid this for many, many years. Well, shall we talk about more enlightened times and talk about our greatest Britons for this week, Max, do you think?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, let's talk about our greatest Briton for this week, Sir William Flinders Petrie. And we'll start with a recap. In the last episode, we talked about Petrie's time in Palestine and his work in Amarna, the city of Akhenaten, the heretic pharaoh, where his dig actually became a tourist attraction and the local Arabs trashed some of the artwork he had discovered in order to prevent the people from tramping all over their fields. He was the first to discover mention of the Israelites in Egypt, and this was on the reverse side of a huge stelae commemorating the pharaoh Meneptah smiting the Libyans, the Israelites, and the peoples of the sea. We also heard about his close relationship with Sir Francis Galton and Carl Pearson, and how Galton funded one of his expeditions in order to collect racial types in the form of heads. Petrie went on to systematize the classification of people into races by head measurements, and was able to predict whether they had the ability to build a civilization or not simply from their head size. These criteria were further confirmed with the advent of IQ testing, which showed that those with the largest brains had the highest intelligence. And we mainly talked about the racial aspects last week, more so than the archaeological aspects. But do you want to add anything to that recap, Max?
Just to say that Flinders Petrie, just like Francis Galton and Carl Pearson and Charles Darwin, for that matter, were a class of people that existed in Britain during the 19th century, who were polymaths and who had the capacity to study a very wide range of fields, and so therefore had might appear to ordinary people as being a sort of an all-encompassing view of the way things are and the possibilities and the potential for the future if we organize ourselves properly. And so my view is that there still will be people of their caliber within our society, but people who are not paid the same sort of attention that they were in their day, but hopefully things might change and we might have an entirely different approach to such people and the ideas that they share in the future.
Yeah, it's almost like they had superhuman intelligence, and they were honoured for that as well. They were the celebrities of their day. People travelled out there to Egypt to have a look at this dig. I mean, that's why these Arabs got upset that their fields were being trampled on. I mean, not like archaeologists today that people probably couldn't even name. These were famous people that were asked for their opinion on things. They were the equivalent of the movie stars and the pop stars that we have today. Only they were being honoured for these great achievements that they've made and the discoveries that they made for Great Britain. Well, in 1923, Petrie was knighted for services to British archaeology and Egyptology. The focus of his work shifted permanently to Palestine in 1926. From 1927 until 1938, he excavated Palestine under the auspices of the American School of Research. And while he was there, he discovered the ruins of 10 cities in Tel el-Hisi. He began excavating several important sites in the southwest of Palestine, including Tel Jemma and Tel el-Adjul. In parallel with his work in Palestine, Petrie became interested in early Egypt, and in 1928, while digging a cemetery at Luxor, this proved to be so huge that he devised an entirely new excavation system, including comparison charts for finds, which is still used today. I mean, he really set the standards for archaeology. He wrote a book on it, which is still in use today, and all these systems that he worked out are the systems that are used today. In 1933, on retiring from his professorship, he moved permanently to Jerusalem, where he lived with Lady Petrie at the British School of Archaeology, then temporarily headquartered at the American School of Oriental Research, which is today called the W.F. Albright Institute of Archaeological Research. So they've given it, they've named it for a Jewish person now. And of course, now that there is a Jewish administration in Palestine and you have the country of Israel, they don't allow any of this digging, any of this archaeology, because it's against the Jewish religion to disturb the remains of Jews. Of course, that's the same reason why they're not allowed to dig around in the work camps either. You got any thoughts on that, Max?
No, other than just really to endorse your sort of interpretation of what's gone on there. And, you know, I particularly like what you said about these people being the superstars of their day. And being as well known as rock stars or people of that sort are today, but being known for their knowledge and also the understanding that they brought of the natural world that people hitherto hadn't yet realised.
Superstars that actually deserved the honours that were paid to them, and also set a very good example for everyone else to follow. Well, Petrie died in Jerusalem on the 28th of July 1942, and his body was interred in the Protestant cemetery on Mount Zion. But he donated his head, and thus his brain, to the Royal College of Surgeons of London. World War II was then at its height, and the head was delayed in transit. After being stored in a jar in the college basement, its label fell off, and no one knew to whom the head belonged. However, it was eventually identified and is now stored, but not displayed, at the Royal College of Surgeons. And we'll talk about this a little bit more later on, but I mean, it does seem rather macabre to have his head chopped off and display it. But this was quite a common thing at the time. If you think that they were really interested in brain size and how that and how that related to whether people were able to build a civilization or not, that tied into it. And also because people were saying, well, isn't it a little bit wrong of you to be digging up these bodies? And he was like, well, I'm quite happy to have my body being donated to science. I'm quite happy to have my body looked at after I've died. So it's not like what I'm doing to these ancient mummies is any different to what I would want to be done to myself. I would want people to be able to learn from me and from my body in the future. So this is the reason why he gave his head to the Royal College of Surgeons. And there are quite a few interesting legends that have sprung up around this as well, because basically its label fell off, that we'll get into a little bit later on. You got any thoughts on him donating his head to science, Max?
Well, there was a paper released quite recently which dealt with the evolution of early man, and it talks about how the vast majority of the interbreeding between early modern humans and Neanderthals took place in the Near East, in the sort of area of Israel and Amman and Lebanon, etc. Archaeologist, I can't remember the name of the archaeologist or where I read this now, just on the spur of the moment, but the point is the archaeologist, who was a lady, was mentioning there about how they're able to interpret the morphology, the sort of facial structure and the shape of the bones that form the face of a very large number of skulls from both sort of Neanderthal graves, but also from early modern graves, and also from modern humans that live throughout not just the Middle East, but also Europe and South Asia, and going north eastwards into Siberia and China. They've analysed the faces of these people, and what this archaeologist was saying is that you can determine the line of inheritance and the degree of inheritance of Neanderthal DNA by just examining the morphology of these skulls. Now, the morphology of Flinders Petrie's skull would obviously be an anatomically modern European person. But by the same token, if you find skulls, then you are able to define them by their facial morphology and determine what race the person was whose skull that was. And so, if you can determine whether the person was one of the tribes of San people in South Africa. You can determine whether they are a Negro from the central parts of Africa. You can determine whether they are Hamitic or Nilotic from the northern parts of Africa. You can determine where they come from in Europe. You can determine whether they came from Southeast Asia. You can tell whether they are from China, etc. And so, that there is a massive amount that can be interpreted from the shape of somebody's skull. And I would imagine that Flinders Petrie's skull would be a very interesting skull to examine.
Yeah, because you have to bear in mind this is before the discovery of DNA, when we can look at DNA and see what someone's inheritance was. So they would look at a skull and look at the measurements. And as you're pointing out there, Max, they'd be able to work out what the inheritance was. And something else that strikes me is, you know, you compare what these men look like. I mean, they're all very handsome, and you compare them to the sort of people that we have leading the government today that are supposed to be very, very intelligent. And of course, they're incredibly ugly. So it does seem as if being a polymath and being highly intelligent correlates with having good genes, being symmetrical, being handsome, and it's all tied together with high intelligence as well. Well, Petrie himself married Hilda Erlin in London on 26th of November 1896, and the couple had two children, John and Anne, and the family originally lived in Hampstead, London, where an English Heritage blue plaque has been placed on the building where they lived at 5 Cannon Place. John Flinders Petrie, that's his son, he became a noted mathematician who gave his name to the Petrie polygon. And if you remember at the start of this, we talked about how Petrie's wife's father was a famous explorer. He gave his name, I think, to somewhere in Australia, and their son gave his name to the Petrie polygon. So you can see that the intelligence is passed down through the family. Getting into his legacy here, Flinders Petrie's painstaking recording and study of artifacts set new standards in archaeology. He wrote, "I believe the true line of research lies in the noting and the comparison of the smallest details." And up to that point, it had all been about finding the largest finds and the biggest statues, but he was interested in looking at small things and looking at the pottery. By linking the styles of pottery with the periods, he was the first to use seriation in Egyptology, a new method for establishing the chronology of a site. So he standardized that as well, so that people could tell exactly what period it was that they were looking at when they were digging. Petrie was also responsible for mentoring and training a whole generation of Egyptologists, including Howard Carter, who went on to discover Tutankhamun's tomb, and on the centennial of Petrie's birth in 1953, his widow, Hilda Petrie, created a student travel scholarship to Egypt. So the most famous find ever in Egypt was carried out by one of Petrie's students, conforming to Petrie's instructions. Many thousands of artifacts were recovered during excavations led by Petrie, and they can be found in museums worldwide. A medal was struck in celebration of his 70th birthday, the Petrie Medal, when funds were raised to commission and produce 20 medals to be awarded once every 3 years for distinguished work in archaeology, preferably to a British subject. So we can see there that there is this loyalty to his ethnicity. The first medal was awarded to Petrie himself, 1925. And the first few recipients included Sir Aurel Stein, 1928, Sir Arthur Evans, 1931, Abbe Henry Breuil, 1934, Professor J.D. Beasley, 1937, Sir Mortimer Wheeler, 1950, Professor J.B. Wace, 1953, and Sir Leonard Woolley, 1957, another archaeologist that I find quite fascinating. He's the chap that discovered Ur of the Chaldees. He was very famous for the digs that he did in Mesopotamia. The BBC, yeah, do you want to comment on any of that, Max?
No. I was just interested that you had heard of Leonard Woolley before and were impressed with the work that he's done.
Yeah, he was the first to discover what looks to be the origins of the biblical flood. I mean, he dug down and discovered that there was this oily layer, which was just everything was crushed, and there was remains of sea fossils in it. And then underneath it was another layer of civilization. And this layer actually stretched for hundreds of miles at the same level. So it was basically a localized flood that took place in Mesopotamia. And after that, you get the rise of Ur of the Chaldees, and you get the Bronze Age that begins. And before this flood, there was nothing. So it does look as if that was the origin of the flood. That's where I know him from. And the first discoveries of Sumerian civilization and all that sort of thing, which I'm fascinated by. So he was given the award in 1957. And as I was collecting the notes for this, I discovered that the BBC had actually done a documentary on him, or created a documentary on him. It's called The Man Who Discovered Egypt. And the blurb says, documentary about English Egyptologist Flinders Petrie. Ancient Egypt was vandalized by tomb raiders until one Victorian maverick pioneered modern field archaeology. So that's quite good. They actually credit him there with saving ancient Egypt. It was being vandalized by tomb raiders, vandalized by Arabs, basically, until this one Victorian Englishman went there and saved it. Now, unfortunately, the documentary is no longer available. And then I found this piece about the head, and this is from an article written about it. In a recent article for the journal Interdisciplinary Science Reviews, Sarah Perry and I explored the myths around the fact that the head of archaeologist William Matthew Flinders Petrie is a specimen in the collections of the Royal College of Surgeons. We tried to understand the context in which Petrie donated his head to science, his eugenic ideas, his focus on the face, his pedagogical collecting and curation practices, and along the way confronted many of the legends that have grown up around Petrie's head. One of the most famous, that Hilda Petrie brought back her husband's head in a hat box from Jerusalem after World War II, was repeated in the recent BBC 4 television documentary, The Man Who Discovered Egypt. In fact, letters in the Petrie Museum archive illustrate that this romantic legend is just not true. Romantic, arguably, as it has some parallels with wives such as Mary Shelley retaining their beloved ones' body parts. Second only to the legends about how it got to England are the stories about who has seen Petrie's head, many of which are true, some of which we chronicled in the article. Petrie's head became a talking point for archaeologists in the know until the publication of Margaret Drower's 1985 biography, which explicitly states where Petrie's head is. I have not seen Petrie's head and have no desire to do so while it is locked away in its current state, fully fleshed, in a cupboard. Personally, I feel that to gain access just for the sake of seeing the head and saying that I have seen it would be merely titillating and serve no real educational or research purpose for myself or anyone else. So it seems as if this head has sort of achieved some mythical proportions, and it seems people, you know, are actually wanting to see his head. Today, archaeologists are still wanting to actually see the head. It's almost like it has some kind of religious significance. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, after we had the podcast last week, I did actually search on the internet to see what I could find out about this, and there are some photographs of a head in a specimen jar, which would superficially appear to be Flinders Petrie's head, because it's got those, you know, hair of the right sort of description. Although it is, the hair is very dark, and I imagine that either he must have dyed his hair when he was older, or he was remarkably well preserved at the point of his death. But the Beyond that, what I would say, though, is that, that there is much to be learned. And I would think that if the skulls of the other polymaths that we've mentioned, people like Charles Darwin and Francis Galton, etc., if their heads still exist or their skulls still remain intact, it probably would make an interesting project to examine those skulls and see whether there are any significant features to them which could explain the reason for the high intelligence of those people.
That makes common sense, doesn't it? That, you know, if you've got an intelligent person, they're going to have a large head or a large brain, and there might be something different in there. And again, when all this was done, it was before we'd actually came out with IQ tests. So by looking at somebody's face and looking at the proportions and the symmetry and looking at the size of the head, you could guess whether they were going to be a highly intelligent person or not. Well, Petrie remains controversial for his anti-democratic and pro-eugenics racial views, being a dedicated believer in the superiority of the northern peoples over the Latinate and southern peoples. These views spilled over into his academic opinions. Believing that society is the product of racial biology, he contended that the culture of ancient Egypt was derived from an invading Caucasoid dynastic race, which had entered Egypt from the south in late pre-dynastic times, conquered the inferior, exhausted mulatto natives, and slowly introduced the higher dynastic civilization as it interbred with them. Petrie engaged in fierce controversies with the British Museum's Egyptology expert E.A. Wallace Budge, who contended that the religion of the Egyptians was not introduced by invaders, but was essentially identical to that of the people of northeastern and central Africa. However, most of their colleagues judged Petrie's opinion to be more scientific. And the first that I came across Egyptology was through a book by E.A. Wallace Budge, which was on the Book of the Dead, and I can remember in that he was sort of trying to tie in the Egyptian religion with the African religion. And of course, the Egyptian religion, all the gods are white. You can tell that from their proportions in the representations that are actually done of them. I mean, they may be different colours, but the proportions show that they are Caucasian. So why it would be Sub-Saharan Negroes that would have come up with this religion is beyond me. And I think Petrie was the one that was correct and not Budge. And his idea that, but Petrie's idea that they actually came up from the south, I think that's probably not correct. I think they came in from the north. I think civilization began in Mesopotamia, and then I think it spread down into Egypt. I think at the same time in Egypt and Mesopotamia, and also in India, and also in Asia Minor, you had the same essential civilization or different civilizations that were in contact with one another, that were trading with one another. So I don't see how the white people came in from the south, but I do think he was correct. In fact, we know he was correct, that it was originally a white civilization, and we know that as they interbred with the Aborigines, the civilization fell and it had to be revived by white invaders two or three times, at first by Alexander the Great, then by the Romans, and even before Alexander the Great there was a revival, because there was a short period when, what's the name, the Nubians, there was a short period for about 100 years, I think, when the Nubians were actually ruling. The Nubians managed to overrule them, and we can see that the black Africans were treated as slaves, because there were signs that were put up saying that if any black African, any Nubian, is seen crossing this border, they will be executed. And we can also see from Tutankhamun's sandals, which has a picture of a Syrian on one side, which looks very similar to a modern Jew, and also a picture of a black African on the other sole. So he's actually walking on the soles of his feet. He's walking on his enemies. And there are other images of his enemies that were actually found in Tutankhamun's tomb, which confirm this. So they knew about race. They knew that their caste was a particular different race to the caste that they were ruling over. But at various times, they interbred with them. And that's the period. Those are the periods when Egypt collapsed and fell. The civilization actually fell. Any comments on that, Max?
Oh, just that it's long been believed that the civilizations that existed in the Middle East and in North Africa, as you say, were derived from a warrior caste that conquered those areas and then provided the inspiration for that civilization. And the main difference between what existed in the Middle East and North Africa and other places, the difference between those and the rest of Europe and Eurasia basically is that the peoples of Europe who provided the warrior caste that created the greater civilizations were people who were absolutely opposed to slavery and entering into slavery, and so preferred to fight to the death rather than allow themselves to be enslaved. This is one of the common threads that runs through all freedom loving peoples, basically. But the point is that only when the warrior castes ventured down into Africa and ventured into Asia did they find people who they could conquer and who were prepared to allow themselves to be enslaved. And so as a result of the enslavement of those people, they then provided the cheap labor that was necessary in order for the massive monumental works to be undertaken, the creation of temples, the creation of large buildings with all the stone colonnades and all this sort of thing. Those type of ornamentations to the civilization were only possible in those days where the ruling elite of a society had a class of people that were prepared to be subjected and prepared to be enslaved in order to produce it. As far as the rest of Europe is concerned, similar ideas, similar notions would have existed amongst the peoples of Europe existed within the minds of those that had gone to far distant places and created those civilizations. But because the peoples of Europe steadfastly resisted their own enslavement, and as I said, were prepared to fight to the death rather than be enslaved, the expression of the civilization that existed in Europe was less dramatic and less awesome compared with the expression of the civilization as it was in North Africa and the Middle East.
Yes, that's a really important point that you raised there. They didn't have industrial machinery, but what they did have is lots of slaves, and it was lots of slaves that did the heavy lifting to build the pyramids and these structures. They were designed by white people, and then they used the human resources that they found there in order to build them. Whereas in Europe, they couldn't do that. And although we did all club together to raise these giant cathedrals, but obviously that was 2,000 years later than this great civilization that was built in Egypt. Getting back to Flinders Petrie here, his involvement in Palestinian archaeology was examined in the exhibition A Future for the Past, Petrie's Palestinian Collection, because we mustn't forget his contribution to Palestinian archaeology as well as his contribution to Egypt. And a number of Petrie's discoveries were presented to the Royal Archaeological Society and described in the Society's Archaeological Journal by his good friend and fellow archaeologist Flaxman Charles John Spurrell. And Petrie published a total of 97 books, and he made contributions to the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, the old version of the internet. So I mean, he is quite an incredible figure to have in our greatest Britons. Absolutely fascinating character, a great contribution to just knowledge all around, particularly in Egypt, particularly for preventing Egypt from being lost to us, and for all these archaeological sites that he discovered and the information that he was able to actually glean from them. I mean, if it wasn't for him, archaeology would there probably wouldn't be any archaeology today. It would have all been destroyed by treasure hunters. Max, you got any final thoughts on Flinders Petrie here?
No, I don't think so. Other than that, the existence of his head, I find a continuing fascinating thing. And I think that it would be a shame if his head is stuck in that glass jar for the rest of eternity and nobody ever looks at it. And I would like to think that at some point in the future, that there would be an anatomist stroke archaeologist who would have the courage to examine Flinders Petrie's head and compare it with the heads of other notable people, because the skull, I think, of Beethoven has been preserved. I think that from recollection, I think that that Charles Darwin donated his body to science as well, and that his brain exists somewhere. I think that there are the brains of various people that are preserved in jars, and it would be very interesting for somebody to undertake the project of analysing the heads of these people with an open mind, and not just to sort of parrot the usual woke nonsense about, you know, a large brain doesn't necessarily infer high intelligence, and to see whether there is something in the series that Flinders Petrie expressed, and as I say, it would be nice to think that somebody at some point in the future would have the courage to do that and report back objectively on what they find.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? Reporting back objectively. I think all his theories have been found to be true, particularly with IQ testing. But of course, it all gets thrown out now as racist science or eugenics, despite the fact that it's all been found to be true. And recently, Nature came out with a new ethics guide saying that any scientific research that could be used to stigmatize a particular group, so basically any scientific research that shows that there is any difference between groups, should not be reported on. They should just not actually talk about it and not report on the results of it, which is absolutely scandalous. I think he was a fantastic man. I'm a big admirer of him. I'd like to read more of his books, and I'm fascinated by so many of these archaeologists. I mean, maybe it goes back to enjoying Raiders of the Lost Ark when I was a child, because that was based on a lot of these old British archaeologists who were seen as heroes to the nation. As we pointed out earlier, they were the celebrities, they were the pop stars of their day, and deservedly so. Well, I think we'll leave that here for this week then, Max. So thank you very much for coming on today.
No, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.